Residents worried in White Rock.
We urge all residents to exercise caution and remain vigilant.
RCMP revealed new details in a fatal stabbing eerily similar to another attack 3 days ago.
A new dispute in the Surrey policing saga.
What the mayor is doing is completely, completely disingenuous.
The war of words over Brenda Locke's so-called bombshell report on policing costs.
And new homes for wildfire victims.
What do you think of your new home?
Fine, it's really good.
How this Shuswap community is celebrating a major milestone in recovery.
You're watching Global BC. This is Global News Hour at 6.
Good evening. Thanks very much for joining us. Two stabbings in 48 hours have residents in White Rock on edge and the mayor vowing to safeguard her city.
One person died and another is recovering at home after he was stabbed in the neck. Our Grace Key is live in White Rock. Grace, there are chilling similarities between the two crimes.
Yeah, both stabbings, both happening here at the waterfront, and suspect descriptions are also similar. Now, this area is back open to the public, but the investigators spent the day canvassing the area.
Two stabbings near the White Rock Pier just days apart. One man is recovering at home while friends and family mourn the death of Colwinder Sohi. With no arrests, the city is reassuring the public everything is being done to keep the community safe.
To ensure public safety and instill confidence in our community, we urge all residents to exercise caution and remain vigilant. Our priority is the safety and well-being of our citizens.
When the initial incident happened on Sunday, we increased our presence and patrols down at the pier. At the time, it was simply increasing those patrols, those foot patrols that we do routinely, and so increasing the frequency of that. Now we will be bringing in extra members so that we have a presence on the waterfront.
At about 9:30 Tuesday night, so he was stabbed at Marine Drive near Cypress Street. He died at the scene.
As I came down to the beach, there was a crime scene in the works here. A man right there being resuscitated, and apparently they worked on him for about 30 minutes.
The Integrated Homicide Investigation Team says it's early in the investigation, and at this point can't say if it was targeted or random.
Whether this stemmed from an incident that occurred a week before, a month before, or whether it stemmed from nothing at all, that's what we're going to determine.
And we also saw a weapon in his hand. It's like silver type weapon.
Jatinder Singh is recovering at home after he was stabbed at the back of the neck Sunday at about 9 p.m. This one appears to be random. He and his wife were sitting on a bench near Tuesday's stabbing.
When we look back, there's a black man wearing a hat with a gray hoodie.
It's a similar description to Tuesday stabbing. A black man about 5 feet 11 inches wearing a hat and gray hoodie with a hood up over the hat. Given the similarities, police are trying to determine if the two are linked. It's left some feeling unsafe in their own community and reluctant to go out at night.
No, never. After 6 p.m., never.
All right, Grace, with both victims being South Asian, are investigators saying whether this might be racially motivated or a hate crime?
Yeah, that certainly could be unsettling for many to hear that both of these victims are South Asian. But I wanted to stress that right now investigators are saying that it's very early on in this investigation and they just don't have a motive right now. But of course, if there are any type of similarities between these victims, that is something that they definitely are going to be looking into. Sophie?
All right, thanks for that. Grace Key reporting live in White Rock.
Violent crime, including the stabbings in White Rock, was the subject of heated debate during question period today. Keith Baldry joins us now with more on that part of the story. And Keith, again, the focus is on this cycle of so-called catch-and-release criminals.
Yeah, it's pretty sure bet, Chris, that whenever there is a particularly violent or unusual or random crime occurring in B.C., it's going to make its way onto the floor of the legislature if the House is in session. B.C. United has raised this issue many times the last few months, particularly with the spate of violence we see spill out from time to time. And that was the case today, referencing the White Rock attacks. Also, as you mentioned, the so-called catch and release, which don't know whether that played a role in this particular crime. But again, the subject of a heated debate. So here's just a bit of it between Attorney General Nikki Sharma and BC United MLA Todd Stone.
Not only did we secure bail reform from the federal government to make sure that repeat violent offenders were kept behind bars, That policy is currently in place, but that we didn't stop there. We've invested in repeat violent offender hubs across this province, 12 across this province right now. We know there's more work to do across the province, but I want to ensure that people know we are putting the resources in place, and these resources are showing results, and we'll keep doing that.
The Attorney General should tell that to Jutinder, who was violently stabbed to the neck in a random attack on the White Rock Pier, or maybe tell that to the family of the second victim who lost his life in White Rock last night. The Premier made a big, big deal about promising better results for public safety in British Columbia, and yet he's delivered a 37% explosion in violent crime. When will this Premier adopt BC United's policies and stop putting the rights of criminals, violent criminals in particular, ahead of the rights of this family and British Columbians to feel safe in their homes and their communities?
So another example of the dominant issue in the legislature session this spring, guys. So again, it's basically street crime is one of the bread and butter issues the BC United keeps bringing up. And of course, the other one is the decriminalization experiment. Look for those two issues to continue to dominate for the next 3 weeks as the session winds to a close.
And carrying on in the public until October in the election, likely. Keith, thanks very much.
Well, it didn't take long for the man charged in a Victoria carjacking on Monday to run afoul of the law again. In fact, it was his third alleged offense in 3 days, adding more fuel to the debate over our catch-and-release justice system. We told you about the carjacking of a Tesla on Monday, which ended when the suspect crashed into two vehicles and was caught by police. Seth Packer was charged with robbery, theft of a motor vehicle, and other offenses. That was his second arrest in 2 days on charges of trying to steal a vehicle. After making a court appearance on Tuesday, he was released, despite police asking that he be held in custody. And just a few hours later, Packer was arrested again after police were called about a man stealing a wallet from a home and trying to steal another car.
We're extremely fortunate that this individual did not cause more harm and that there weren't serious injuries. And these are some of the things that police chiefs have been talking about, is we need to have stronger deterrence and consequences for individuals who repeatedly are causing harm in our communities.
Police say at this point, Packer is being held in custody for his next court appearance.
Just days before the city of Surrey and the province begin a court battle over policing in that city, the verbal fight has taken a dramatic new turn.
As Richard Zussman shows us, a report that breaks down the potential cost of policing is at the center of the feud between Mayor Brenda Locke and the provincial Solicitor General.
It's a report with numbers leading to another massive dispute.
It's obvious that it was being deliberately withheld from the city of Surrey. It equates to $750 million.
What the mayor is doing is completely, completely disingenuous.
At the center, a report from Deloitte. It shows various scenarios for policing in Surrey. One of them comes with an assumption the Surrey Police Service will need 958 officers, much more than the RCMP, and comes with that $750 million over 10-year price tag.
Looking at that report, it is shocking that they never, ever gave that report to the city when we asked for it.
Currently, the police force is only expected to require 834 officers to police Surrey, and even though there is a requirement for SPS to have two officers in some patrol cars, Public Safety Minister Mike Farnworth says the staffing numbers will be consistent between the two forces.
The police service is being put together by the Surrey Police Service and the board. The model that is in place in terms of service is the model that in place that will continue.
And beyond the numbers, the National Police Federation is worried about its members. The union representing RCMP officers say they are currently being held hostage by the long, drawn-out transition.
We were releasing about 20 bodies a month, believing that SPS bodies were going to be coming in and backfilling. That never happened.
The union also suggesting while the transition is still underway, the province will need to move officers from other RCMP detachments to Surrey to keep up the force minimum.
Do the members that are currently in Surrey have to stay and continue to police and support the Surrey Police Service, or are we going to have to bring in members from elsewhere?
RCMP officers transfer to other detachments. They retire. New ones come in. Surrey Police Service is engaged on hiring new officers.
And this war of words now moves to the courts, with the province and Surrey set to square off starting on Monday. Richard Zussman, Global News, Victoria.
With the backdrop of increased property taxes and cuts to crime prevention programs in Surrey, some are surprised to learn the city of Surrey is actually hiring for some new positions in communications. Catherine Urquhart reports.
The Surrey Crime Prevention Society recently learned that $300,000 in funding had been suspended by the city of Surrey.
We didn't have any clue that this was happening. So they're telling us 4 months into the fiscal year that we're no longer getting funding.
Surrey Mayor Brenda Locke's explanation of the grant suspension is that it's under review.
We are taking a look at those grants to make sure that that money is going into the right place.
Meanwhile, the city is spending more on communications. Its senior manager of communications makes close to $160,000. Its media relations lead earns about $75,000. There's a new hire for multicultural communications, and three other positions are advertised.
We said we would be transparent. We said we would be accountable, and that takes people and communications to help with that. And of all the people to ask that question, I would think the media would be happy about that.
More importantly, are Surrey residents happy? Taxes are going up 7%. And funding is suspended to the Surrey Crime Prevention Society. But there will be more communication staff to provide an explanation. Catherine Urquhart, Global News.
The BC government is starting to get a lot more pushback from a growing number of municipalities over its new housing targets. As Aaron MacArthur reports, they say they're already doing their part and accuse the province of falling short on its responsibilities.
I'm calling BS on this priority list.
New Westminster, one of 20 more cities where the provincial government will be mandating housing targets.
Purpose-built rental? Purpose-built rental. That's the kind of housing we're getting approved.
The mayor taking exception to being put on a list he says the city doesn't need to be on.
New Westminster has consistently been one of the fastest growing cities in the region and is now the second densest city in all of Canada. We are doing our job as a city at getting housing built.
It's a similar story around the province. Mayors pushing back on these newly announced targets. The city of North Vancouver also on the list, and like New West, exceeding their regional growth targets.
I made it really clear to the minister in conversations, you know, growth can't be scaled up because we're given a target.
In Coquitlam, where growth has accelerated around the Evergreen Line, the concern goes beyond targets. Richard Stewart concerned the new provincial government rules around housing types and density is having the opposite effect on housing markets.
We're actually going to end up with less housing built this year than last year.
The housing minister says these targets aren't meant to be punishment or an admission cities aren't doing the needed work, instead saying there are specific items municipalities can do to create more housing faster.
Well, each community has slightly different things that are needed. The city of North Vancouver needs more affordable rentals. The city of New Westminster has been planning on 2011 numbers. The lot has changed since 2011.
A report on the progress of the original housing target list of 10 cities will be made available later this spring. The individual targets for the latest round of cities named expected to be released in June. Aaron MacArthur, Global News.
They lived through one of the most terrifying events of last summer's wildfire season. The Bush Creek wildfire roared through the First Nations community of Squilax on Little Shuswap Lake as survivors hid under a nearby bridge to survive. Today, a milestone in their recovery as they move into their rebuilt homes. That's coming up next on the NewsHour.
Immensely, it's changed my life.
Graduation day for guide dogs and their people and the difference it's made in their lives. Plus,
I just want to be the stepping stone of people to realize how incredible these octopus are.
The Vancouver Island diver known as the Octopus Whisperer, part of a new documentary about these amazing creatures coming up later.
Right now, though, an Indigenous community in the North Shuswap is welcoming members home. 8 months after a fast-moving wildfire tore through the area.
As Angela Jung reports, today's homecoming was a somber celebration of how far they've come and how much more healing there is still to do.
Holy, that's really nice.
Squilax elder Wilfred Toma, impressed by his new home.
What do you think of your new home?
fine. It's really good. Everything is real good.
His home, along with 33 others, were destroyed by the Bush Creek East wildfire last summer. All that's left are memories.
But coming back into a community again, you know, it will help me to realize that I'm not the only one that lost anything out there from the fire.
The ferocious inferno rained down embers, providing little time to escape. It was all hands on deck trying to save properties.
It's kind of a blur because you're in the mix and you're fighting and, you know, you're just trying to save people's homes and buildings. And
many band members have been spread out, displaced until their community is rebuilt.
From a community just being ripped apart to now, it's quite the, it's pretty emotional for sure.
As an electrician, he's now part of the Rapid Housing Project.
The nonstop grind of just going every day to make this happen.
We want to, you know, push for this to be done so our kids can be here and have fun and, you know, have their place of home back.
This Dancing Fawn 2 subdivision has 11 homes. People can start moving in the coming weeks. It's one of four new subdivisions being built.
The last band member can open a door and close it behind them and says, I'm home, then I can build mine.
The road is difficult, but I want to assure you that Indigenous Services Canada will be there as a true partner every step of the way.
The chief says seeing the progress made has lifted a huge weight.
I'm very proud of our community. They're learning to be a community again. I'm very proud of that.
Coming together to bring people home. Angela Jung, Global News.
A starving dog found tossed over an embankment in the Postel Lake Road area near Kelowna is now in the care of the SPCA. A man was unloading his bike from the back of a truck when he noticed a pet carrier over the bank. He went down to check it out and found a dachshund tied inside. The dog was brought to an emergency vet clinic. Once he had stabilized, he was handed over to the SPCA, where a volunteer named him Wilfred. Wilfred is still recovering, and it's unclear when he'll be ready for adoption. If you would like to help with Wilfred's care, you can donate on the BC SPCA website.
Glad he's recovering. All right, up next, burning questions in the logging industry.
They're using wood to generate electricity.
A researcher who says skyrocketing demand for wood pellets is putting immense pressure on BC forests.
And risky eating, why more people are pushing the limits of best before dates.
Jason Pierce, co-anchor for Global News Morning. I just think people have a natural curiosity to know what's going on in their backyard. What I love about Global is we're so uniquely and intensely local. As journalists, it's our duty to sift through all the clutter and find the information relevant to British Columbians, people that live in our communities, and that's the news that we want to deliver.
Local news every day. We are BC's News.
A new report claims a growing number of logs from BC's forests are being turned into wood pellets and burned to generate power.
But as Alyssa Thibault reports, the provincial government flatly denies claims that logs from old growth forests are being turned into those pellets.
It's long been a practice in BC's logging industry, taking scrap wood and turning it into pellets. But a new report is casting doubt on where the wood is coming from.
The reality is that tens of thousands of trees every year taken from primary forests are getting turned directly into wood pellets. I saw other ones being built.
Analyst Ben Parfitt has spent years researching the province's pellet industry. His latest report alleges whole trees from primary forests are being turned into pellets, then sent overseas as fuel for power plants.
I went to many pellet operations. I saw the walls of logs that were awaiting conversion directly into wood pellets, and I saw some of the forest lands where those logs were originating from.
The report also found in the last 10 years, pellet exports to Japan have risen from just under 62,000 to nearly 1.7 million tons last year.
Three quarters of everything that was exported from our province last year by way of wood pellets went to one country, and that country was Japan.
The BC government has faced these accusations for years, and the forestry minister maintains pellets are mostly made from scrap wood like sawmill shavings.
Let's be clear, forests are not being turned into pellets.
The minister adding such a practice doesn't make economic sense either.
Whole logs are much more valuable as whole logs and being turned into lumber being sold to sawmills than they are and turned into pellets. The price difference is huge.
Though Parfitt believes there isn't enough scrap wood to satisfy the huge volume of pellets being exported.
Turning wood from precious, irreplaceable primary forests into a product to be burned is not an acceptable use of our wood fibre.
The company which operates most of BC's pellet mills also denies the allegations. Alyssa Thibeau, Global News.
Coming up, Canadians hungry to save money.
You don't want to throw it out if you can actually utilize it.
With food as an increasingly valuable commodity, how some are willing to gamble with best before dates.
Also ahead, Labatt Breweries makes a big investment that allows you to crack a drink and feel better about the environment, too.
Bringing you behind the scenes in the corridors of power, asking questions on the issues that matter most to British Columbians.
People are frustrated. They don't believe that your government is doing enough.
Focus BC. Uncovering what happens here. Holding politicians to account.
Delivering in-depth analysis.
Because politics matter.
Well, with Canadians feeling the ongoing impact of inflation, many are still looking for ways to save, including at the grocery store.
A new report indicates some are more willing to look past best before dates. But Sean Preville shows us why experts say you should still be careful.
Checking an item's best before date is fairly common when grocery shopping. Canadians want to know how long their food will last. But as Canadians look to save on food, some are even ignoring the date to make the food last longer.
Food is now an asset, and you don't want to throw it out if you can actually utilize it in a way.
A study by Dalhousie's Agri-Food Analytics Lab set to be released Thursday, but shared with Global News in advance, found 58% were more likely to consume food near or past its best before date. The study found of that number, 23% say they always eat such food, with another 38% saying they often do so. Yet nearly half of Canadians consuming potentially risky food were unsure if it could make them sick. Food scientist Keith Warriner says a best before date is not the same as an expiration date.
The best before date is basically the company's best guess when the quality starts to deteriorate.
He says it's not necessarily an indicator of safety, and several foods are usually okay to eat after the best before date, like chips or dry food.
One good way to determine if something has gone bad is through your own senses. If it smells off or looks spoiled, it would be wise to toss to avoid getting sick.
When it comes to illness, the study found a total of 1 in 5 Canadians said they got sick after eating food near or past its best before date. Sylvain Charlebois says that is a surprising number, given getting sick could also mean a missed day of work.
If you get sick, it ends up costing you even more money than throwing that food out.
As Canadians look to save on food, Warner says while eating food near or past its best before date may help you save, there's another thing you can do to save even more.
When you go shopping, don't try to get these spontaneous purchases. Buy what you need.
Sean Preville, Global News.
Labatt Breweries of Canada is investing $9 million in a Delta brewery to help eliminate single-use plastics. The funds are for new machinery at the Turning Point Brewery on Anisus Island. The new machines will eliminate the plastic rings you see on six-packs, among other environmentally friendly initiatives. Labatt Breweries of Canada says this latest investment is part of an ongoing capital spending plan to enhance facilities across the country. Labatt says it's been listening to feedback from the community, which helped drive a more environmental approach.
We're seeing a huge demand from customers to have their products packaged in a more sustainable way and also in a way that basically allows us to put them into the market in a more durable way as well.
With this substantial investment, Labatt is not only upgrading their machinery, but also taking a bold step towards environmental responsibility by removing plastic rings from their packaging. And this move aligns Labatt with our city's vision for a cleaner, greener future.
Labatt still uses plastic for shipping, but this investment will keep those plastic rings out of landfills and oceans to help protect marine mammals and birds.
A special way to mark International Guide Dog Day for one Vancouver resident this morning, Ellis Parsons and their dog Jazz are graduating together as part of the Canadian National Institute for the Blind Guide Dogs Class of 2024. Parsons and the two-year-old Black Lab are among 23 other graduating pairs in New Westminster. They've been together since January, and Parsons says the guide dog has helped them regain their independence.
Really immensely, it's changed my life. I think that, you know, for me, I was really starting to slow down a little bit using my cane. And so to be able to, you know, walk quickly again, navigate those busy mall spaces, things like that, that I sort of, you know, started giving up as a cane user, I'm really going back to you now and realizing how much I love doing those things. And so that's been really transformative.
The Institute says not only do the dogs help their people navigate traffic, public spaces and other obstacles, they offer constant companionship, too.
Coming up, Secrets of the Octopus, BC's underwater paradise, showcased in a new documentary that will give you a better appreciation of these intelligent and elusive creatures.
And later in sports, missed opportunities. What the Canucks say about allowing the Predators to even up the series.
I'm Colleen Christie, and I'm the anchor of Global News at Noon. It's important to know who is delivering your news, and we're in your neighborhood. We're part of your community. We have the same concerns and the same challenges as our viewers. Knowing that means that we have a greater connection with our viewers, and that generates greater trust, and that's what local news is all about.
Local news every day. We are BC's News.
Concerns about the summer water supply are already coming to a head in Kelowna, with the city putting a cap on water usage for struggling local farmers.
As Jaden Wozni reports, some local cherry farmers fear this could decimate what little remains of their damaged crops.
Farmers are finding out about this, and they're not taking it really well.
Kelowna farmers like Harsh Kayla will soon have their water allotment capped at a maximum of up to 27 inches, a move the city says is to help combat expected drought conditions.
We're in the early stages of 2024, but we are concerned that because of the drought conditions, because of conditions from last year and leftover, that we may or may not have enough water for how we normally operate the system.
But Kayla says restrictions on irrigation could have devastating impacts on the local agriculture industry.
So once we hit our limit, are they going to come turn our water off? Like, our trees are going to be, you'll see all the trees around wilting over, and we don't want that to happen.
This decision couldn't have come at a worse time for local cherry farmers. As cherry trees in the Okanagan Valley begin to blossom, the damage from mid-January's cold snap is becoming evident.
Overall, like, we have no crop around the valley, and cherry industry is suffering for sure. And I think same goes for grapes and everyone else as well. Like, no one who's doing farming this year is having a great time.
To help local farmers prepare for the potential impacts, the city is offering free on-site advice about irrigation system management for those who went over their water allotments last year.
We need to re-educate ourselves sometimes, and this is one of those opportunities. We're providing some irrigation management to some of those users if they require it. They can call the city and ask for that opportunity.
Kayla says he's doing everything he possibly can to conserve water, but he's also at the mercy of Mother Nature.
When we go over, it's for certain reasons, and it's more Mother Nature than personally us wanting to go over. Water also is a negative to cherry trees, where if you over-irrigate, it causes diseases. So we're always looking out not to water more than we need to and have a balance.
As for urban water users, City Council made no mention of any changes to the odd even year-round water system currently in place. Jaden Wozni, Global News, Kelowna.
All right, let's bring in, on that note, let's bring in senior meteorologist Christy Gordon with a look at our weather forecast. And we are hoping to see some, well, we have seen some rain today, or at least some spitting on the way in
today. Spitting for sure, in the lower mainland anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, today was a little bit on and off the rainfall, but one thing for sure, you likely felt how cold it was. I'm wearing my turtleneck because of that. Hard to believe. Here we are in spring. I'll have more on that drop in temperature, but I wanted to show you this. Obviously, everyone in Cranbrook saw these incredible clouds. These are lenticular clouds. I've spoken to you about them before. They look like UFO and they're stationary clouds. We had so many people send us photos of these, so I'm going to go through them. Yeah, so what they're created by is a wave in the atmosphere, and at the crest of that wave you get this lenticular cloud. Again, it's stationary, and because of the wave you tend to get several of them in a row. So everyone was probably looking up going, what? We got to send that to Global News. And so here are all your photos. Thank you to everyone who shares these photos with us. It really is cool to see. All right, so big change in temperature today all across the province. Some areas a change in temperature by 11 degrees. So that's over the last 24 hours, and we're going to remain cooler over the next little while. So, for example, in Metro Vancouver yesterday, we were at 21. Today, only 12 degrees, and it's going to be a touch cooler again tomorrow. Typical for this time of year is 14. Tomorrow is going to be much more consistent, the rainfall. This system moving in, shifting in the interior regions later in the day, but certainly periods of rain expected across the South Coast. Brighter conditions, though, for those of you in the north. And we're talking about 10 to 20 millimeters for the South Coast area. So you'll definitely need either your turtleneck or your rain jacket. So brighter conditions in through the north, although the BC Peace River area will see a few showers across the southern regions. That precipitation shifting in later in the day, whereas we are expecting the rainfall across much of the South Coast throughout the day. So highs of only 11 degrees. Yikes. Typical for this time of year is 14. And your five-day forecast is looking cool and wet. But we've spoken about this before. The cool, wet weather is exactly what we need right now. We don't want to melt that snow, and we need the moisture in the ground. Tonight's Central Windows weather window coming to you from Vetter Crossing, where these beautiful red tulips were captured on camera. And I also was alerted to the fact that the Harrison area also has a tulip festival going on, not just Abbotsford. So if you want to get out there and check those out, you should. Thanks to Lynn for this great shot.
Beautiful. Thank you, Christy.
All right, Squire joins us now with sports. There are some positives to take away from that Game 2 loss. The Canucks certainly had their chances.
Yeah, I thought Vancouver was a better team last night. They just didn't capitalize on their chances. And of all the Canucks' near misses in that game, the Elias Pettersson miss at the end of the first period was the most shocking.
If I score in the first period and it's a 1-1 game, maybe it's a different outlook. So,
yep, makes you wonder if his confidence is low right now. We will talk about Petey and the other stars who are not scoring right now.
All right, thanks, Squire. Also tonight,
they're the most mysterious creatures on Earth.
West Coast octopuses are the star of the show, narrated by another celebrity you'll recognize.
So the Canucks were the better team, but...
Yes, they were.
They just didn't.
But they lost. Get the win. Just the same. I know. You know, the Canucks have secondary scoring going in the playoffs so far, and that's an important ingredient for playoff success. But you also need primary scoring. Stars have to shine, too. And Vancouver's stars are being eclipsed so far against Nashville. Now, the series isn't over because it's 1-1 and Demko is hurt. Vancouver can still win this best of seven for sure, but JT Miller, Brock Besser, Nils Höglander, who I really haven't noticed, to be honest with you, Connor Garland, Quinn Hughes, although he does have two assists, and Elias Pettersson, all of them have not scored a goal. And to zero in on Petey for a moment, not only has he not scored, doesn't have an assist, and in two games, he's a team worst minus four. Last night, Pettersson had a bad game. He knows it. He gave the puck away that caused the third goal. He missed a wide-open net. We showed you that just before the break. But Rick Tocchet feels that Pettersson is getting a hard lesson about what it's like to be the big-money player on a team that's expected to cash in on its talent in the postseason.
In reference to Petey, he's a young kid. You know, this is his first kind of taste of pressure playoff thing, and, you know, this is good for him. He's got to learn that, he's got to dust himself off and be ready for game three. And he's got to be very decisive with the puck. I want to see him shoot the puck. Like, he's got to take it. Like, and I think he'll be fine. I mean, this is good for him. Good learning lesson.
I'm always my biggest critic, and I take a lot of blame for this one. I put us in a bad spot with my mistake on their third goal. Can't happen. If I score in the first period, it's a 1-1 game. Maybe it's a different outlook. So, yeah.
Now, it's not just the Canucks failing that has this series tied. Nashville did a lot last night to win. It scored on the few chances it had. And even though Nashville now has the better goalie in this series, they held a block party in front of UC Soros. I don't think you could have counted the amount of bruises and welts on the bodies of Nashville Predators players who stood in front of Canucks shooters last night.
JT Miller finds Hironic. Open as Hughes takes the pass. He shoots. Another block. Hironic. Miller! Blocked again. McDonough. That hurt.
We were committed to the pain. And I think something that maybe game one we learned from a little bit. Maybe weren't quite as committed to the pain. I thought in tonight, with the block shots and the things that we did, sacrificing our body, so we learned, and we're still growing. We're not where we want to be, but we're getting better.
The Nashville Predators readily admit that they haven't been the better team at 5-on-5, yet they have a chance to grab a 2-1 series lead on home ice come Friday. Canucks limiting the Preds to just 16 total shots on goal in Game 2, but between Nashville blocking 30 shots and the Canucks misfiring on another 32 that never saw the net, it's all even heading to Smashville for games 3 and 4.
It's been a fairly even. Maybe they've had a little more zone time. I think that's something that we can definitely work on a little bit better, getting a little bit more offensive zone time. But at the same time, I think we're doing a pretty good job keeping them on the outside. There's been the goals obviously have been kind of shots through from the point, and one was tipped in. I think the one even today hit one of our guys, unfortunately, but the sacrifice is there too. Like, that one was a great try for the blocking, and I think we're doing a pretty good job at that. But like I said earlier, they got some guys they can hurt you if you give them too much time. So I think maybe a little bit advantage to them 5-on-5, but like I said, we're learning every game. We got a lot of experienced guys and a lot of guys that are just getting taste of playoffs. And this is definitely going to be a long series, and we're trying to learn a little bit every game. And I thought today was a good step from first game. And now a couple of days to regroup and go back to Nashville and try to do it again.
You may have noticed Kurt McClain and Ryan Kessler cranked the siren in the first two games to get the fans cranked up even more at Rogers Arena. Now, Vanni Sartini has never seen how this city reacts to playoff hockey until he saw Game 1 on Sunday night. But being the enthusiastic Vancouver resident that he is, he would love to get involved. In fact, he would love to do the pregame siren if, of course, the Canucks wanted him to.
Yeah, I think so. I think I can do it. I don't want to do the... I think I'm not able to do drop in the puck, because I would fall in the ice for sure. I would fall in the ice for sure, but probably to do the crankle, I can do it.
Fafa Pico was the Whitecaps Player of the Month in March, but he missed last week's game in Seattle after being hurt the week before against the Galaxy. He went out after 15 minutes with a bad back. It really threw the Vancouver Whitecaps off that night. So is he ready for this weekend's game against the very difficult New York Red Bulls?
Clinically, he's healthy. You know, he's been week out with this problem on the back, and now he started training again. Of course, he didn't do a full training yesterday, He didn't do a full training today. He will be available for sure for Saturday. I don't think in which capacity and in how many minutes he's going to be cleared to play. But he will be traveling to New York for sure.
Fans of the Vancouver Canadiens might recognize this young man. Addison Barger played for the Seas in 2022. This is his first Major League game tonight, playing for the Blue Jays against the Kansas City Royals. They hit the ball to him. What do you got, kid? He's got no fear and a good glove. Nice catch by Addison Barger. There you go. Kansas City is leading 3-2 in the sixth inning right now.
Nice.
There you go.
All right. Thanks very much, Squire.
All right, what has eight arms and sounds like Paul Rudd? A new film starring BC octopuses. That's next.
It's true.
I'm Jordan Armstrong. I'm the anchor of Global News at 11. Local news is more important than ever, I think, because these are the issues that affect you closest to home. These are the issues about your child's school, your community centers, your healthcare system. It all starts with local. And you have a voice in these issues, and we want to hear it.
Local news every day. We are BC's News.
Jordan Armstrong is here now to talk about what's coming up on Global News at 11, including some breaking wildfire news. Jordan.
Yeah, Chris, homes are being evacuated due to a 40-hectare wildfire that's broken out south of Chetwynd in northeastern BC. We're hearing Highway 97 is also closed. The fire broke out just this afternoon, and the wind is not helping. The evacuation order covers the Pine River area near Chetwynd. We'll stay on top of this throughout the evening. Also, parents in Surrey are rallying in support of an early learning program that's at risk of being scrapped. Strong Start helps kids make the transition to kindergarten. Coming up later tonight, why parents say the province has a responsibility to increase funding. We're back at 11 with a full hour of late local news. Chris?
All right, Jordan. Thank you very much.
A creature of the deep living in BC waters is being highlighted in a new show. The giant Pacific octopus is getting the star treatment in Secrets of the Octopus.
And as Kylie Stanton shows us, the production would not have been possible without the help of some dedicated Vancouver Island talent.
It's like leaving one world and entering another. Now, 2 years and 1,500 hours of filming later, audiences are being welcomed in with open arms, or more accurately, eight of them.
It was really exciting to see.
And Crystal Janicki has seen her fair share of exciting things.
I had had so many, like, really amazing encounters, super special.
Which is why she was tapped to be part of the new National Geographic series, Secrets of the Octopus, paired up with a fellow local cinematographer, Maxwell Hahn, to capture the giant Pacific octopus.
I took them on one of our first exploratory dives, and they decided that, you know what, they'll just get the local to film because he knows this area a lot better than we do.
The duo spent hours underwater looking for just the right one, and the patience paid off.
We ended up finding one that really kind of took us under one of her tentacles and became pals with it, and she led us across a lot of the reef to show us where she hunts for crabs and things like that. It was really amazing.
Their work makes up the Canadian part of the series that documents octopuses from five countries, showcasing divers gaining their trust and forging a bond while capturing never-before-seen behaviors.
It just felt like magic.
All of it backed by some major star power.
Because the executive producer is James Cameron, it's quite publicized. And we've got Paul Rudd narrating the series. So it's received a lot of attention, and so far it's been very positive and everyone's really enjoyed it.
But Janicki isn't letting the screen time she's had go to her head.
I just want to be the stepping stone of people to realize how incredible these octopus are.
The hope is the series will help drive conservation efforts. Those involved say there is no doubt eight tentacles will be pulling on everyone's heartstrings.
It's really, really cool to have people wanting to learn more.
Kylie Stanton, Global News.
Can't wait to see it.
They're so cool.
So cool.
And smart. Remember that year the octopus was picking the winners of the World Cup?
Oh, right.
That's right.
He never missed. He made a lot of money. Now lives in a mansion.
And there was that movie, My Octopus Teacher. too, right? That was based
that was
in
very cool.
South Africa or something. It was very cool.
Did they teach, what did they teach, math? Because they have so many arms, they're good at counting?
Yeah, you know, that'd be pretty good.
Well, sorry. Sorry. It was a weak attempt.
No more octopus jokes. Last word on weather before we go, Christy?
Sure, they're such fascinating animals. All right, we are expecting wet weather. Cool tomorrow as well. You definitely need your rain jacket tomorrow, by the way. It's not going to be spotty rain like what we saw today.
All right, thanks very much, Christy. I don't blame you for trying the octopus. You know I'm a sucker for octopus jokes.
And dad jokes. What about octopus dad jokes?
Right.
Let's get off the air before we even go down that path. Have a great night, everybody.
Good night, all.